Okay, lesson seven. How do we work? Yes, lesson seven. Isn't that good news through the years? Being from New England, I talk with people often, especially when I lived in Florida, but still when I live here, who don't understand hockey. There are rules and there are strategies that people just don't understand about hockey. Okay? And as a result, these people don't really enjoy watching hockey. And if you want excitement, forget the World Cup. Playoff hockey, in my mind, is very exciting. But of course, now it's buried on like NBC Sports and no one can watch it unless they have the special cable package. But the church is kind of the same way, I think. People are often frustrated because they don't understand how it is that the church works, how it functions. They don't know who is responsible for what, and therefore they don't know how to seek possible change in certain things. Okay? So that's what this is about, this lesson. Okay? The big idea for today is that living as God's people requires submission to the authorities Jesus has established. Our membership question is, do you submit yourselves in the spirit of love to the government and discipline of the church and promise to study its purity and peace? And we talked a bit about purity and peace in the last lesson. We're going to focus on the government of the church. And historically, there have essentially been three forms of government. Three basic types of political arrangements, shall we say, political governments in history. There's the monarchy, there's the dictatorship, there's majority rule, and then there's, which I haven't really seen many anywhere, and then there's sort of the idea of representative democracy. And church government is very similar to that. And we're going to start with the episcopal form of church government. Okay? This form of church government is practiced by Roman Catholicism, the Church of England, and therefore the Episcopal Church here in America, as well as the Methodists. They practice this form of church government. And it goes back to that Greek word episkopos, or overseer. And so the episcopal form of church government has power residing in the bishops. Okay? So it is a hierarchy. The higher up the pyramid, the more power an officer has. And if you are a layperson, guess what? You got nothing. Zip. The average person has little to no say in what happens within that body. And so, on the one hand, you have, like, say, in the Roman Catholic Church, you have, this large group of people who are, wish that priests would marry, would wish that there's some that would wish there'd be women priests, and all kinds of different viewpoints. And there's no way in the world they're ever going to change what the church does, because up there handles it all. In the same way, you have a lot of people that were frustrated when the Anglican Church, and the Episcopal Church, as the people way up top began to say, well, same-sex marriage isn't all that bad, and they made this decision towards sin, and all of these people had nothing to say. All they could do is vote with their wallets, I guess, with their feet, and leave, and which a lot of congregations end up doing. It's foisted on them from the bishops. So, what do you think ends up happening, generally speaking, in a system like that?
Top-down corruption.
Yeah, there tends to be a lot of corruption. Absolutely. Anything else? What's the twin sister of corruption? Exploitation. It's a lot of corruption and exploitation that takes place. Okay. The second main form of church government is congregational. This is practiced by most Baptists, not all, but most. Pentecostals, non-denominational churches, And, you know, where we think of the episcopal form as sort of a dictatorship, this is kind of the tyranny of the majority. Okay? It's a pure democracy, so to speak. Power resides in the local congregation. And that congregation is not usually accountable to anyone outside of the congregation. The people control all of what happens in their congregation. So they vote on budgets, they vote on pastors, sometimes they vote on the pastor a lot. what do you think can happen in a system like that?
Mob rule.
Yeah. Sometimes they can, yes, mob rule. It's almost like Lord of the Flies at times. If there's godly leadership, oftentimes it can work very well. Okay? But a lot of times it's sort of mob rule and sin reigns and the godly leadership is booted sometimes because they don't do what the people want. You know, that's how Jonathan Edwards got run out of town. Okay, congregational church. So, comment, question?
Do they typically control, I assume it's only members that can vote.
Correct.
So they do have some level of control of the membership, ostensibly it would be the pastor.
Well, I guess if you don't let people in unless they're your friends,
well, no,
and we'll vote the way you want, yeah.
If you had a bunch of people that just started showing up that had a heretical view,
yeah,
and then they applied for membership, and the pastor basically said no,
yeah,
then they would not be able to hijack the church.
Yeah, you've got to become members.
So there's a little bit of control. I was just curious.
And you know,
it's not a free for all.
It's rare when it gets ugly, or you know, gets as ugly as it could be. But the problem is the pastor is always looking over his shoulder for his job. He has to know that he has enough people in his corner that he can always fight off the crowd, so to speak. And that means that there's often going to be an unhealthy kind of compromise, a compromise of principle. A healthy compromise is compromise of preference. Unhealthy is compromise of principle. So
the pastor survived a popularity contest.
Yeah.
Higher fire. It's more like a higher fire.
Yeah.
A lot of times today they don't have church membership. Churches, a lot of them don't have membership anymore.
Yeah.
So it's more, you're in because you come so many times.
Mm-hmm.
It's very subjective.
Yes, and those are actually run more like an Episcopal church, but you know, Tucson, the Bridge, I think, is very much like that. You have elders that really, I don't think they've been elected by anybody, and they govern this multi-site body and membership. I don't even know if they have membership, but. It's very hierarchical there. Yeah. At least it was when I read the website when it was still a cool church.
But like some non-denominational churches, they're really run by the pastor. It's strictly a charismatic, and is you know, so they're really in that informally.
Same way, I saw this in Winter Haven in the area, there were a group of churches, and it was the pastors of each that made up the ruling body over all of those Word of Faith churches. And so no one would ever see a budget or anything except the guys. And so it was functionally an oligarchy, you know, and it's just like, okay, where do you come up with that from the Bible? And my goodness, what kind of corruption is that hiding? So I don't pretend that our system is perfect, but I do think it is a biblical system, and that would be Presbyterian form of church government. Presbyterian does not refer to our theology; it refers to our form of church government, And it is similar to what the United States of America used to be, a representative democracy, a constitutional republic. Okay? Now it's turning into an oligarchy. Power resides within the church courts, and those church courts are accountable to one another, and people are able to elect their officers who serve in those church courts. So it's a representative form of church government. You vote for officers, and the officers discharge responsibilities. So it is very important that you choose wisely when you choose officers, because they'll be making a lot of decisions. For instance, in our we'll get there later. Let's go to the church officers right now, unless there's a question with Presbyterian government in theory. It too can be corrupted. Yeah. I've seen that happen, especially if you have non-rotating elders. If you have the right guys, that's a great system. But if you have the wrong guys, you're maintaining the status quo for generations. And it gets... Ugh, I've seen that too. All right.
How is our church officers? I mean, are they just there for life, or are they rotating?
We've got them for life. Unless they do something really bad.
Or need a break.
Like Marty right now is on sabbatical for a few months. So... for the rest of this year. After his dad died, he realized, I need a break. So we were happy to give him one. I've been telling him to take one for about 4 years. So.
In other words, once you have the leader set up, nobody else can be a leader. They all stay the same.
No, if we see qualified men, we're content to add them to the others, yeah.
Oh, they're not... Replacing
him. Yep. Yep. Yeah. The more we have, the better, in a sense. As long as they're godly men and wise men, I have no problem with us adding more. I want us to have more.
But if we end up like being really huge and had, like 20, you'd probably start rotating them out.
Yeah, I guess harder. Maybe. Yeah. Or just.
Those meetings are not good.
They don't go fast. Yeah, the more people you have, the longer the meetings are. So, because not everyone, but more people want to get their 2 cents in. It's our human need to feel heard. So, even if we're on the same page. We theoretically have 2 church offices. Some people say that we're a 2.5 office church, our denomination. I might think we're sort of 3-ish. Elder is the first one, and this is one of the half kind of thing. Are teaching and ruling elders the same? And that's really kind of the question that people disagree on. Their teaching elders have more responsibility than ruling elders. There's things I can do that those guys can't do. Like I can administer the sacraments and they can't. That's why it sounds like this is actually 2 offices, not 1. But I'm sticking with 2, with 1, and this one. Elder. We see this in Titus 1. This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife, his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination, for an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered or a drunkard or violent or greedy for gain, but hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. He must hold firmly to the trustworthy word as taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to rebuke those who contradict it. There is a whole lot we could spend talking about here. We're going to give you the Reader's Digest version. Okay, elders are to be men of strong, godly character. this character is to be revealed in their home life. Okay, so there's, you know, it's not just theoretical, it's visible. Okay, elders are to be men, not women. They are to be men who know and believe the doctrines of the church. Okay, so it's not just intellectually going, I understand it, but I believe this, I embrace this. This is because elders are to instruct and correct the people. They are entrusted with the majority of the ministry of the word. Okay, then it's not exclusively just elders, obviously, but this is what they're supposed to be doing. Elders are therefore also to be involved in the lives of the people, addressing their spiritual needs. So, from the form of government, it is the responsibility of ruling elders, both individually and jointly, to guard and promote the spiritual welfare of the congregation. They are required by their office to visit the people, especially the sick, and pray with them, to comfort the sorrowing, encourage the weak, guide the wayward and the careless, and in general, to discharge all duties in Christian love. Not easy to do in our culture, which runs so fast, and guys are so busy, families are so busy. I don't think 2,000 years ago they had soccer practice and piano lessons and blah, 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 blah. So life is far more hectic and it's more of a challenge, but that's still, this is what we're supposed to be doing. Okay? And if a guy's not willing to do that, then they don't need to be an elder. They need to do something else. Okay? Any questions before we move on to the second office? All right. Deacons! And the body of deacons is called the diaconate, but don't be confused. It's not spelled like deacon. It's not D-E-A. It's D-I-A. And it's diaconate. There's your fun little trivia thing for today. Deacons, likewise, must be dignified, not double-tongued, not addicted to much wine, not greedy for dishonest gain. They must hold the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience, and let them also be tested first. Let them serve as deacons if they prove themselves blameless. 1 Timothy chapter 3. And so we see that deacons also must be people of strong and godly character. Deacons are not, as one person expressed it to me, the worker bees of the church. They must also know and believe the doctrines of the church. They're just not entrusted with them to teach them, but they have to believe them. Be able to communicate, at least to me, some of those things. Okay? Deacons are to be involved in the lives of people, addressing primarily their spiritual needs. Sorry, their material needs. Okay. So, the form of government says the diaconate, see? IA. I don't know why, but that's the way it is, even though everyone tries to spell it EA. Okay, the diaconate shall be responsible for the congregation's ministry to those in material need or distress. It shall also encourage the practice of total stewardship among the members of the congregation. It shall have the care of the general property of the congregation, both real and personal, meaning land and buildings, as well as money. Okay.
What does total stewardship mean?
Oh, more than money. So it's money, time, that kind of stuff. So, and that's really something that I think a lot of churches struggle with, a lot of diaconates struggle with, is helping people to be total stewards. So, each of you as a member of the church will be part of a shepherding group that will be comprised of an elder and a deacon. And when everything is going right, they should periodically contact you and make sure everything is going okay. We try to make sure that they do this, but short of putting iron to their bodies, it's hard. So, that's our desire, is for them to be in periodic contact with you, making sure you are okay. There's nothing to be praying for, you know, in terms of material needs, spiritual needs. If there's, you know, if there's a sin that you're struggling with, that's a good, you know, please pray for this. If you need counsel, if there's an area where you're discontent, you know, I've noticed this going on, can we talk about it? You know, that's a place to bring that up as well. You know, no one, I don't know. But it's an opportunity for communication to be both ways. Okay, so that's what we try to do. We're not always as good in the implementation as we want to be, but always a good time to remind the elders to get in contact with their people. A lot of it happens informally in community groups, but not everyone's in a community group. So, all right, any questions on deacons before we move to the three church courts? As exciting as that is.
So, just a question. You said that there's a deacon and an elder mm-hmm. that's given to members. There's one to call me. Just to give oversight to those people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, if you have a problem, that would be the primary person to talk to first. Doesn't mean you can't talk to me, or if there's an elder that you know otherwise that you'd like to. We try to divide them up, you know, considering community group, but also personal relationships. You know, if you have a personal relationship with a particular elder already, then we'll try to assign you to that particular elder as long as their list doesn't become humongous. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we try to keep it relatively balanced. So, and we need to get the deacons more involved in that, I think. We're trying. So, as the congregation grows, we're going to need more elders, I think. So I'll be praying for elders. Okay. All right. Three church courts. The first, and these are kind of, you know, there's a sense in which there's hierarchical, in that the ones higher can tell the ones lower what to do, but the ones lower can make requests, but not demands of the ones higher, if that makes sense. So it starts with the session, and the session is comprised of the teaching and ruling elders in a local congregation. So the session here is myself as the moderator, Marty Beal, Mike Pixley, Jerry Horbert. Okay, that's the session. The session exercises spiritual authority for the peace, purity, and prosperity of the congregation. It handles local church discipline. It works in conjunction with the diaconate for the well-being of the church. And as the local church authority, it has authority over the diaconate. And sometimes I've seen places where the diaconate doesn't like that. But that's the way it is. Okay. The presbytery is the next one up, and that is comprised of teaching and ruling elders within a designated geographic area. Although occasionally it's not geographic, like we have some Korean presbyteries, for instance, and those cross all kinds of geographic lines of other presbyteries, but because of the cultural and language differences, they exist. So, let's see, where was I? The presbytery assists local congregations to seek the peace, purity, and prosperity of the congregations. So, you know, a lot of what they're supposed to do is being an assistance to the local church. Don't think of them as sort of bishops, but there are times when decisions are made and as long as it's in keeping with the scriptures and the constitution of the PCA, you know, we should be submitting. We took a vow of submission. So, but that's rare. Okay. Also, the presbytery controls membership to the presbytery. I forgot to put that in. So we examine. So, you know, when I was called to be the pastor of this church, I also had to be examined by presbytery to make sure that I was sound in doctrine. It wasn't just the church wanted me here. They had to agree. And if they don't, then and I've seen that before, the church starts all over again, you know. Hopefully not from scratch, but maybe one of the guys that they, well, okay, let's look at this guy again. Okay, so General Assembly is the third court of the church in the PCA, and that is comprised of all teaching and ruling elders in the denomination. Its intention is to assist presbyteries and congregations to seek the peace, purity, and prosperity of the church, and it serves as the highest court in matters of church discipline. So, for instance, if you're involved in a church discipline case and you don't like the ruling, okay, yours would be handled by the session in the local church. So if you don't like the ruling, you can appeal to the presbytery, and the presbytery can hear that. And if they rule, again, like you don't like, you can appeal up to General Assembly. So there's a right of appeal that you have with the decisions of the session. So... Where you have standing anyway. I mean, you can't complain about, I don't know, the session chopped down a tree and I don't want them to. You know, you can't appeal to to presbytery about that. Now, different Presbyterian denominations have the real power in different places. Okay, the PCUSA and the old PCUS. That the PCA came out of, the power was in the General Assembly. It was functioning very hierarchically, top down, and you see that today in the USA. That's why a lot of churches are leaving, is because the assembly is doing all kinds of things that the grassroots people think are nuts, for good reason. And so the power in the PCUSA is in the General Assembly. When I was in the ARP, it's more in the presbyteries. Okay, that seems to be where the real power is. And in the PCA, because it's in a sense a reaction to PCUS, the power really seems to be in sessions. So I'm not the only person who has observed that. So, and so we talked about submission to authority, and why I mentioned that was Hebrews 13, obey your leaders and submit to them. For they are keeping watch over your souls as those who will have to give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. Okay? God commands us to submit to our church leaders, obeying them. Okay? There are limits to that. We cannot bind your conscience. That's something that's found in the Westminster Confession. So we cannot bind your conscience. We cannot tell you to sin. Okay, so there are limits to that. It is to both parties' benefit for that people to do this, so that the elders, the leaders, are joyfully watching over people, and the people experience the joy of being watched over well and with joy. Okay, church leaders are accountable to God. Okay, when things happen that you don't agree with, you got to remember that phrase. They will have to give an account. I have to give an account for the decisions that I lead this congregation into. So that should sober me. And they are still the elders. And that should be a good reminder to everyone else. I don't have to hold them accountable. God will. God's better than I am. He has more power and more wisdom in how to do this. So, you know, if a session sins, if there's corruption there, then that can be addressed. That needs to be addressed. Okay? So this is not, you know, take it regardless. And if there's serious problems, they need to be addressed in a godly fashion. So this is not absolute power by any stretch of the imagination. So, but being Americans, we tend to act as individualists and be autonomous. So that whole submission thing can be tough. So, all right, living as God's people means respecting and following appointed leaders. Okay. So our practical implications are that you, because it's not me, I don't elect anybody, you are responsible to elect officers who will serve Christ's interests over people's interests. Men who will do God's will. And that we are all responsible to follow the lead of the elders. There are decisions that are made sometimes that I don't agree with, but I'm called to submit unless they're sinful. So, and every elder has that same thing. When we make a decision as a session, it's a session decision. We don't 2 months later go, well, all that was Mike's fault. Or, I didn't agree with that one. You know, when we stand before the congregation with the, it's a session decision. It's not a Steve decision. It's not a Marty, Mike, or Jerry. It's a session decision. All of us. Okay? And I will let you know that my general ethos is if it's a tie or something, we need to come back to it later. We're not forcing an issue down someone's throat. And most of our decisions are unanimous. We have consensus. In my time here, I can't think of any major decision we've had where there's someone who's ticked off at that decision. So we're generally of one mind. So I think it's far healthier than my experience in another place where it was almost always seemed to be conflict taking place. So, and I've got our mission down there just briefly. By God's grace, we offer the life-giving gospel to the spiritually thirsty so they can worship the one true God and grow in gospel understanding and practice. So, that finishes that lesson.